Think you're already right. Recording.
Yeah, I just double checked. Cool. So what's up, everybody? This is a live public call. So we have our private call in the Action Academy community on Tuesdays now. So every single Tuesday, we have a speaker coming in. We have Ben Kelly tomorrow for Action Academy that's speaking on buying businesses. So his specialty is buying small businesses where each business replaces six figures of cash flow. So that is his job. Imagine the possibility of having one acquisition replace your entire job. And that's take home. That is our call tomorrow within Action Academy. So that'll be super fun for all my Action Academy fam on here. I will see y'all there, Mason, as well. In the meantime, there are some of you that are, you know, maybe a couple rental properties deep. There are some of you that may be 10 rental properties deep. And some of you on this call may be trying to buy your first rental property. Regardless of where you are in your journey, today's call is going to be exceptional for you, because Mason is a wonderful example of going from quite literally not zero to 100, but he did go from zero to 36, I believe 5 months and 27 days is how long it took him from having a primary residence and not knowing anything about real estate investing to learning about what's a broker, how do I contact them, to closing on two different properties in two different states on the same day for his first official real estate investment transaction. And since that point, I flew him and his wife out to Cabo with us, and then we were able to celebrate together. And then Mason, we're adding to the portfolio here shortly, right? What's about to happen?
Yes, sir. We're going to be closing on another 26 units on Friday.
Let's go. Man, congratulations. Everybody, round of applause for Mason. Let's go.
Thank you.
Oh my goodness gracious. So this call serves in a couple of different ways. I like to play games where they benefit everybody. It's all about aligned incentives. So for me, this is a cool opportunity to share Mason's story. And then at the end, we'll allow him to share all of his information, his social handles, his email, so that you guys can have access to him if you guys want to get on some of the deals that he's doing as well, because I'm very proud of him. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and introduce the man. Mason Miranda, how do you introduce yourself now to the people, you seasoned investor, you real estate dog?
How do I
introduce myself? Who is Mason Miranda? Who is Mason Miranda? This is your podcast intro, man. We got to get you seasoned on the podcast now.
Oh, yay. So excited about the podcast now. I'm Mason Miranda. I am a more seasoned than before investor in real estate. My focus is in commercial multifamily, right? We currently own 36 units total over two separate properties. One is a 24 unit in Texas. Another one is a 12 unit in Kansas City, Missouri. And very, very small seasoned investor, we have been doing a little bit of everything from capital raising to actually finding the deals and creating relationships with brokers to underwriting them to actually running them and being the asset managers. We find property managers to run them boots on the ground for us, because I'm lazy and I do not want to have to be there in person all the time. That's a little bit about me and what we're doing in real estate. I'm not sure if there's more that I need to say. Brian, did you have something in mind?
Oh, I was thinking we could just kind of hang out for the next hour, maybe next 60 to 90, and we could all just kind of smile at each other. Y'all look beautiful today. It's beautiful and sunny today. No, man. So what we'll do today is we're going to break it down, because what you did a wonderful job of, and what I recommend to every single person that's listening to this, and no matter where you are in your journey, the dollars are in the documentation, you know, because how many of you are maybe on your first couple of properties and you're like, dude, I can't for the life of me figure out how to get this property. I'm priced out of the market. The interest rates are going crazy. I've been trying to do this for 6 months, a year, 18 months. I still can't make it happen. Mason documented, actually, what does it take to make it happen within 5 months, and I think 27 days. So let's begin from the very start. Maybe if you have it ready, do you have like maybe your post that you posted in Action Academy, like the screenshot of that, so we can start there? And then we could just dissect it in the different categories that you presented from within the post, because you broke it down into, here's who I networked with, how many people I talked to, how many people it took, how many deals I had to look at, et cetera. So we'll start there. And let me see if I give you permission. Yes. You have permission to share your screen.
Perfect. And what I did is I actually just took screenshots of like different sections of that post and just threw it into some notes. So I'll just share that. That way it's a little bit more relevant for us here.
Perfect.
All right.
Wonderful.
I'm going to make this go away. Go away.
Whatever. Maybe try it in Spanish.
Yeah, since we just learned that Mason speaks Spanish and Brian is learning how to speak Spanish, so
yeah.
How slowly. Close are you to that, by the way? Have you learned a lot?
I don't know, Stephanie. How am I? No,
not good yet. Yeah.
No, estoy practicando mucho, man. Well, yeah, that's why I come down to Tulum to practice. All right, so let's begin with the synopsis. So I'll read this out, and then we'll just break it down piece by piece. We'll just kind of do an interview style because this will make for a wonderful podcast as well. So first off, I'll read this for people listening and not watching. One is a 12-unit multifamily property in Kansas City, and the second is a 24-unit motel in Texas, right? Yeah, Texas. All this is done in 5 months, 3 weeks, starting from the day I joined Action Academy. I like those people. They're pretty cool. Before that, my only experience in real estate was purchasing 2 single family homes for personal use. For any newbies or real estate peeps looking to ramp up their game, here are the numbers that led me to where I am today and what it took from when I started almost 6 months ago. Please note that I don't post this to gloat, but to show what I did to get to this point. So let's start with the network growth, Mason, because people are the most important part of the deal. And I think people underestimate how much networking is actually required, because everybody hears on podcasts, reach out to mentors, reach out to people, but nobody actually is like, okay, dude, what does that look like? 2 people a week, 5 people a week? Who am I reaching out to and how many? I'll let you take the floor here.
Yeah. So the biggest thing that I've learned over the last year is that real estate is a team sport. Period. The more people that you can have on your team, the more people that you can work with, the more people that you can partner with, the easier your life is going to be, especially if you're brand new to all of this. Like Brian said, like I literally started at level zero. I bought my own house just from my own personal use in New York, sold it, moved down to South Carolina, bought my own personal use. Like that's literally it. And so starting from level zero and moving forward, it is especially important for you to grow that network and just meet people in the thing that you're trying to do, right? So if it's in commercial multifamily, hone in on growing your network there. If it's people in self-storage, hone in on growing your network there, but make sure that you're surrounding yourself by those people that can help you grow, that are not where you are or below, but that are ahead of you. Okay. And so what that looked like for me when I first started, my goal originally was just to meet as many people as I possibly could. Cause I did understand that my network was, I think Brian puts it, my network is my net worth. And so the people that you surround yourself with are going to get me there. And so my goal at first was connect with 2 to 3 people every single day for the first month. That is really how I grew my network as quickly as I did. And most of those connections were done within Action Academy, right? The reason that I personally focused on Action Academy and growing my network there was because I knew and know that Brian did most of the vetting for me. I knew that connecting with people in Action Academy would already push me a little bit more forward, because Brian already brought go-getters, people that are doing stuff that know what they're doing, that are good mentors. So I already had a select group of people that was vetted and ready for me to connect to and that I could trust immediately. So that was my biggest focus at first. And then once I came out of my first month, I started connecting with people outside of Action Academy, especially with brokers, wholesalers, agents, et cetera, et cetera. So when you're looking here, just to break this down, so the 286 people met. And that's in between my day one. I shouldn't say day one of starting, because I didn't actually start tracking until about a month after I joined Action Academy, but about 286 people between June and November. 110 of those people were in Action Academy. 130 of those people were like brokers, agents, wholesalers, sellers, lenders, etc. You know, everybody that can actually get the deal done. 46 were potential capital partners. When I say potential, I just mean people that I met that said they have money, but not necessarily willing to partner up with me just yet. And then one of the biggest things Brian also talks about is tracking your progress. So like I said, about a month after I joined Action Academy is when I started tracking my progress through social media. And between June and November, I had 114 posts on social media tracking through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking and that network. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Here, 1 second. Let's punctuate this because like you don't have hundreds of thousands of followers, right? No. Like you have a normal Instagram, but you still get DMs from people mm-hmm. that are wanting to partner, wanting to give you deals, wanting to give you money, correct?
Yes. Yep.
And this happens left and right. So the biggest limiting belief that you guys can have is like, you maybe you guys see my Instagram following now and you're like, oh, it must be nice, right? But like, I didn't even have that a year ago. Like I just mm-hmm. post a video every single day. And so it's all about just documenting your journey and your story. And I promise you, like the ones that I've had the most that, you know, the videos that took off or the posts that took off, they weren't the ones where I was like prancing around Mykonos or anything. And they're ones in my car, like in a garage in the gym parking lot, talking about a lesson that I learned. And I think that's a really important lesson for every single person listening to this. The type of stuff that Mason posts, which we just posted his Instagram in the chat, if you guys want to go follow him, is every single step. He's like, okay, hey, like this is a conversation I had that went really, really well. Here's how I framed it. Or like, this went wrong with our property. Here's how we're fixing it. Or I'm fixing the sign. Like, here's how we're going about it. Just stuff like that. You're just updating your journey. And people love that type of stuff, especially a before and after. So I'll let you get back to it here. I just wanted
A little carrot to what you just said as well is I'm going to be totally honest with y'all. I really am not the biggest fan of social media and updating it. Like I'm fine hopping mm-hmm. on and watching everybody and scrolling through and, you know, finding whatever I think is funny and memes and all that crap. But I personally am not the biggest fan of updating. And so to be honest, especially when I first started, it was tough for me to really post every day. My goal was to post every single day and maybe miss like one day a week. And I got into a habit where I was doing it, but my goal originally was just to take no more than 5 minutes a day to put these posts together because I just hated doing it. And to be honest with you, it's still not my most favorite thing to do, but mm-hmm. I've seen that it works. Just like Brian was saying, I get DMs from people because people are like, oh my gosh, that's actually how I've met my mentor, who is my go-to partner, mentor, everything. The only reason I connected with him was because I was posting and showing what I was doing. And so you might not like it, but do it because it's going to help push you forward. So just a little carrot to add on to you there, Brian.
Mm-hmm. It adds validity. It adds validity yes. and track record because if you see somebody pop up on Instagram and maybe they have hundreds of thousands of followers, it's very easy for them to just buy them and fake it. Whereas if you see somebody with a podcast or you see somebody with content that goes back multiple years, that's a pretty good litmus test that you guys can use for anybody that you're following or anybody that you're mm-hmm. partnering with. So let's go into the mentors. How the heck did you convince people? We'll make it an easier question because in Action Academy, like that is why you joined is for mentors. Right. But let's do outside of Action Academy for people that you were approaching that didn't know you from Adam. How did you get into their world and get them to reply?
Well, and honest to goodness, you can actually include a lot of these things within Action Academy as well, because whether you're part of Action Academy or not, these people don't know you. They didn't know me when I first started, and you needed to help them understand who you are. I'm just this random dude, especially when I started Action Academy, literally with zero properties. And here are all of these other awesome people that own millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of real estate. How do you talk with them? The biggest thing that I would suggest starting out with is add value to them first. Okay. Reach out, mention that you want to chat with them. Don't take more than 10 minutes of their time max, because they're busy people. These people that are doing stuff and moving, they're busy. Okay. They don't have time to sink half an hour to an hour sitting on the phone chatting with you because you don't know whatever it is that you want to do with your life. Like sit down, figure your stuff out, make sure you understand, okay, this is my goal. This is what I'm trying to accomplish. Come up with 3 to 5 questions that you really, really, really need answered to get the ball moving. Ask these people to hop on a call for 10 minutes of their time and say, look, man, or look, woman, I have these amount of questions, woman. Whatever, sorry. Listen to me, woman. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry. I probably shouldn't say that.
We get what you're saying, but that was hilarious. Yeah.
Anyway, so look, I have a couple of questions. I just need you to help guide me as I'm moving through. Ask those questions and then make sure that you get to know them and figure out What are they struggling with? Just as an example, one of the very first people that I connected with, I learned that they were super struggling with underwriting. They just, they could not keep up with underwriting. They couldn't keep up with the amount that they had in. So I went to them. I was just like, look, I literally have no idea how to underwrite. Give me 15, 20 minutes of your time. Teach me how to underwrite. Teach me whatever it is that you're doing, and then send me your deals and I'll underwrite them for you. Let me take them off your plate. I will underwrite them for you. I'll shoot them back. I don't expect anything else. All I need is for you to teach me how to underwrite, and that's it. And that's how I really got going. I did the same thing for finding deals. I did the same thing for capital raising. I did the same thing for operating. Reach out to these people, serve them, add value to them, ask questions for clarity, for you to learn, for you to understand how to do things, and then go out and actually do it. And you'll be amazed at the amount of people that are like, holy, what? This dude is just like helping me because he wants to help me. Dude, I will do whatever I can. I will bend over backwards to help this guy because I can tell he gives a crap about me. Does that make sense? That answer your question?
Absolutely, dude. You crush it at this. And I will add like a small thing that I've learned over doing this for about 6 years now. Is what I'll do is it's like a small little like sales trick. It's called a pattern interrupt or a pattern disruptor. I'll say, hey, can we hop on a call for 12 minutes? Or like something like that. Even when I submit offers, it's always like a really odd number because it's a pattern disruptor. So it's just like, instead of like 400,000, I'd be like, okay, I'll do 392,500 or 392,594. And they're like, they think that there's a reason that you came up with that. And so even today, when I'm texting people that I'm friends with for years that are still important people and really high level investors, I'll say, hey, quick question. It'll take 11 minutes or like it'll take 7 minutes. Can we hop on? Instead of just say, hey, I've got a quick question. I never say that. It's a punctuation to show that you appreciate their time. And 9 times out of 10, if you lead with that and say, hey, quick question. It'll take 9 minutes. Can we hop on? They'll normally go on with you longer. But and like, it's just please, night and day different.
Please don't say, can I pick your brain? Please don't say, can I pick your brain? Please don't say that.
I'd rather you pick my nose than for you to pick my brain.
Yeah, so please.
So let's go into the team here. So, you know, for somebody that's a single family investor, of which there are many on this call and many listening, what's the team that needs to be built, and how'd you go about building this team for commercial?
Yes. So for single family home investors, I will say it's probably a little bit different than what you would be looking at for the commercial multifamily, just commercial in general.
I meant single family going into commercial.
Got it. Yeah. Okay, perfect. So when you're building out your team, what you're looking at here is you want to find people in my opinion, you should definitely partner up with at least one, maybe two other people. And what you're looking for is people to complement your weaknesses. All right. Figure out what you're good at on a deal when it comes to a deal, and then figure out what you're not good at and find someone that can do whatever it is that you're not good at. The example that I always give for me is that I know that the first thing that I just told y'all what I learned how to do was underwriting. I hate underwriting. I hate numbers. I hate hopping into Excel to have to do all of that. What I know how to underwrite, I've learned how to do it, and I can do it very, very well, but it takes me twice to almost three times as long as someone else, like my partner that's a mechanical engineering background that's been doing Excel his entire life, and he loves numbers. It takes me almost twice as long as that dude, just because my brain just doesn't work that way. And so I knew once I learned where my strengths and weaknesses lied, I needed to find someone that was crazy good at underwriting, and then I would go out, find the deal. I enjoy talking with people. I enjoy creating relationships. And so my natural strengths fell under like the deal finding side of things and the capital raising side of things. And so I took upon myself though that specific part of the deal and found someone else to take over the underwriting piece so that it complemented that weakness of mine and helped smooth and streamline that process. So when you're looking at this team build out here, I built a team of three within the first month and a half, almost 2 months. That was me finding an underwriter that I knew was just a baller. She was awesome. She is awesome at underwriting to this day. And she knew what she was talking about. And she was a little bit farther ahead than me, which was also great because I basically was adding value to her by bringing her deals, letting her know like, hey, let's go under contract together and let's move faster. And she was underwriting these deals to make sure that they were actually the right way and teaching me all along the way of how to do that. we expanded our team and tried our luck with having a larger team and trying to grow. To be totally honest with you, I tried to grow way too quickly. I definitely shouldn't have looked for that many team members at first. And we've actually scaled back since then, which I can get into at the end if we have any time for that. But I've actually scaled back since when I wrote this, just because there were too many people on the team. And again, my reason for saying that and what I learned is that when you have too many people on the team, deals just kind of get lost and there's not really enough work to go around. And so maybe you have five people on the team, but you got two or three people doing all the work and two people sitting on the sidelines. Like, what am I doing?
What's going on?
And the three people doing the work are like, well, why am I paying these guys part of what should be my share if they're not even doing anything? So anyway, that can get all into the weeds, but essentially you just want to build out that team. Two, maybe three people total on your team to really help get you going and complementing those weaknesses.
Okay. And then the team comprised of, and then this is your team that was a little too big, but three yes. underwriters, a mentor, a company or optimizer, deal finder, asset property managers, deal finders, capital raisers. Yeah. Asset management is it's a much different, it's a different beast than acquisition. So and it can be said in multifamily and commercial, like it's a win for you to buy, but like the celebration and the champagne bottles are after the refinance. Mm-hmm. It's after the disposition. So when you guys buy, like the buy is wonderful, but it's like when you refinance successfully and you return capital, that's when you really celebrate. A show of hands right now, who's listening to this and you're thinking to yourself subconsciously, this sounds like a lot of work, right? You're like, okay, like this is a lot. Mason, how much money did you put into this deal when it was done?
I've only put $120 of my own money into all this.
How big was the deal? Well, the two deals?
The two deals, 24 unit, 12 unit.
In the dollar amount?
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. The 12 unit was 1.185 mil. And granted, the motel was only $130,000. That was the bigger one. Oh, that was the smaller one. But
bummer, man. But yeah, so between those, almost like, yeah, I think, you know, over $1 million of asset value, having a piece of that, putting $120 down. Guys, remember the deal triangle. You need money, knowledge, or hustle. Mason didn't have money at the time. So he was like, I'm going to hustle until I get the knowledge. And now he has knowledge and hustle, which is dangerous because now he can just be able to go and scale up to 100 plus units. And then eventually Mason's going to be the one with the money and the knowledge, which is the most like pinnacle position to be in. And then you can have an army of underwriters and operators underneath you. So let's go into the deal flow. So this is where everything, you know, everything comes to a head right here. So let's go over, you know, how many deals came across your desk? How many deals did you underwrite? And most importantly of all, how many offers were sent out before we were able to get this one accepted?
Yep. So in between June, when I really got going in November, and again, I didn't track as well as I should have. So these are kind of estimates here. About 250 deals were found. Okay. I personally, by myself, underwrote 76 of those. The other 174, I underwrote with other members in Action Academy, either teaching me how to underwrite, double checking my work, making sure all of these 76 were really my first ones for me to learn and try to force myself to learn how to underwrite quickly. Mm. Once I actually got to being able to submit, I understood what the numbers were. I understood, okay, I'm finally starting to find deals and underwrite them in a proficient way. I was able to start submitting LOIs on these. Once I started doing that, again, in between June and November, about 57 LOIs were submitted, which frankly is pretty small compared to a lot of what other people have scaled their system up. It's really, really small, comparatively speaking. But yeah, so 57 LOIs submitted about. Of those 57, about six of those LOIs were accepted. And of those accepted LOIs, only four went under contract. When I talk about accepted versus under contract, I mean the seller came back and said, yes, we like what you submitted. Let's start working towards a contract. In between them liking it and actually signing something legal stating you are now under contract with me, something misaligned, whether the seller wanted to hop or I found something that I didn't like anymore during a little bit of a due diligence period, so we pulled out there. from under contract at four to closing. Of those four, we only had two actually close. Other two fell out during due diligence. One, again, was a little dirty little secret that we found on a mobile home park that we got under contract with. The city had rezoned it where I wasn't going to be able to operate it as a mobile home park anymore if I were to purchase it. So we're like, nope, out. The other one, the seller was trying to hide. It was a $900,000 acquisition. The seller was trying to hide about $500,000 worth of money that I needed to sink into it in order to get it operating where it needed to be. And just because of how shady they had been from the get-go, we decided to pull out of that one as well. So that's what it looked like from LOI to being able to close on November 15th.
So what I like here is, and like in Action Academy, these are metrics that we're going to be hammering home on, because everyone's asking kind of like that. It's analysis paralysis just from lack of clarity from the assets. So when I look at this, all I see from like my sales brain and operations brain is, okay, you have almost a 10% acceptance rate for your offers. So when you guys were writing your offers, like, and if you know, okay, so for me to close one, let's get under it needs to be under contract on like five. So if I have a 10%, that means I need to submit 50 offers. So it's like you can just reverse engineer the math to your acquisitions, ladies and gentlemen. Instead of just winging it, you can put like some pretty quantifiable metrics. I have a guy where he's like, dude, if you make 50 to 100 offers, like I guarantee you a deal. Now, the cool thing about offers is you look on the MLS or you look on Craigslist or LoopNet, and maybe you guys see something that's listed. That list price does not need to be the price that you offer at, because a lot of us are guilty of seeing something that's listed and we say, can't find any deals. None of these make sense. It's because you didn't offer. You didn't offer. So Mason, walk us through quickly the format about how you guys were the process for which you guys were submitting offers, obviously with seller finance contingencies as well.
Yeah. And the little carrot I should add to what Brian just said as well is that we always submit offers. Even if we come in, let's say it's a $2 million deal and we can only come in at $1 million, we still submit the offer because you never know where the seller is at. You never know what is going on. And if you submit the offer, sometimes it strikes a negotiation piece where the seller's like, look, I can't do a million, but here's what I can do, and y'all can work something out that way. So with that said, to answer Brian's question, the way that we approach submitting these offers is we typically submit about three options in an LOI. Okay. Typically we do one full cash offer. When I say full cash, typically I mean just like a bank offer. The second one is a full seller finance offer, meaning that the seller is going to act as the bank for us. For those of you that don't know what seller finance is, the seller will essentially assume that loan on their end. We don't have to go to a bank, and you can be so creative with all the terms that you want, everything from interest rate to amortization period to balloon payment, whatever that looks like. You can be crazy creative, and oftentimes a deal works very, very well if you can get that creative for both you and for the seller. And then the third option that we submit is a half cash bank financing and a half seller finance creative offer, which is typically what a lot of sellers like to see, where you're bringing a large sum of cash up front and then they carry themselves as a seller a little bit of the loan long term. So they're making money on their down payment up front while also making money on interest through a loan that you're paying them over the course of the next 3, 4, 5, 10 years, whatever that looks like. When we're underwriting our deals, we typically use, we just have a little template that we've built for ourselves that we plug all of our numbers in. And when we're underwriting it, we basically change the numbers so all of their income, their expenses, all of those will stay the same. We fiddle around with what financing terms can be and what purchase price can be so that we can find the numbers that work for us, not for the seller, but that will allow us to work with the seller to see if there's some kind of negotiation piece where, no, we can't bring this much down payment up front. But instead of bringing a large down payment, we can get you maybe a little bit of higher interest rate so that you're making more money long term.
Dude, that was explained absolutely wonderfully. Like there's no simplicity I can add to that. That was perfect. Literally.
Thank you.
That was very well explained. So let's take a quick pause there. Any questions from that? That was a lot. That was a lot of information. That was the best that it can be explained. But first, I want to see if there's anything that we need to clarify before moving forward. Any questions, guys, feel free to either raise your hand, speak, or post in the chat. Going once, going twice.
Hey, confirm
you. It's always on the third. All right.
Yeah. Hey, Mason, what was the decision point, man? It looks like you're looking at a couple of different deals. You're going with this kind of boutique hotel. You did multifamily. You're doing some mobile home park. Like, any decision tree to be kind of looking at so many different asset classes all at once and then end up doing with two kind of different asset classes versus just like niching down and focusing on one?
Yes, that's a fantastic question. And to be honest with you, I started much more open than I am right now. I'm really honing in on commercial multifamily alone. I haven't really been looking at mobile home parks. Every now and then I look at hotels and motels, but about 90% of my time is spent on commercial multifamily. Just so you know now, that was a mistake that I made up front, was spreading myself too thin, looking at too many different types of deals. I would definitely suggest honing that in. But to answer your question on, okay, how do I hone that in? I think my question to turn around to you would be, do you have a good feel for where you are trying to go and what you are trying to achieve in the next 3 to 5 years? Because if you do, if you have that goal between 3 and 5 years out of, okay, this is where I want to be, this is my cash flow, this is the amount of time I want to be spending on my real estate, this is this, that will heavily influence the asset class that you want to get into. Because different asset classes require different types of system setup, different types of time spent upfront versus long-term, and different asset classes will also deliver different amounts of cash flow at different points of you owning that property. Okay. So when I'm looking at multifamily, for example, the commercial multifamily field, what I found is that if I put in just a crap ton of work in the first year, maybe two, to get a system up and going long-term, I'm not going to have to spend as much time managing these properties, getting the deals into my pipeline long-term, because in those first year, maybe 2 years, I have that system already set up. And so I'm a little bit more hands-off long-term. Now, the caveat there is in commercial multifamily, I may not get as big of a cash flow number as I would buying businesses. Now, if I go to the business route, I'm going to make a lot more money from the get-go all the way through however long you're doing it. However, on the business buying acquisition side of things, you're going to be putting in a lot more work for a longer period of time. And so you just need to figure out what your goals are and which asset class is going to fit that goal. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, and so there's a couple of questions in here from Jack and from Dan where they're like, isn't that shiny object syndrome? Looking at a wide variety of asset classes. And then Jack says, want to quickly touch on how this isn't shiny object syndrome. So yeah, guys, in the beginning, look, the best way that I can describe this, I'm trying to find frameworks within which to simplify this. And the best framework I can find is, are you going to go on one date and find your husband or wife? You know, like, no. You're not going to go on one date and be like, oh, all right. So, and, you know, some people, maybe that's the case and you're lucky, and you know. But for other people, it's you go on a date. Maybe you date someone for 3 months. Maybe you date someone for a couple of years. And that's the process that you use to determine, what do I like? What do I not like? What traits and characteristics are important to me? Which ones are not? And so Mason now has the context within which to make an informed decision on his asset class, because he was exposed to the different asset classes. And like that is why. And I would also argue that the underwriting more or less was relatively in the same ballpark, because he was underwriting commercial loans. It wasn't, I'm underwriting a business and looking at seller discretionary earnings. Then I'm going to use that same mental energy, and now I'm going to code switch to underwriting multifamily. And then I'm going to code switch to underwriting short-term rental, and I'm going to go on AirDNA and look up that. It wasn't that. It was, he knew he wanted to do commercial. He just didn't know which asset class fits within that the best. So in the beginning, I would say cast the net far and wide, and then eventually you will hone in once you get some confidence and you get some properties under contract and close. And Mason may even close this next 26th unit, and then maybe he finds something else, and then finds something else, and then within which he can make more informed decisions. A couple more on this. Stephen asked, how do you handle educating sellers on what seller finance is? Mason, I'll let you hit on this really quickly, and we'll go to Dashima. But from my experience personally, you're not going to get a seller finance deal done if they don't previously really know what seller financing is. Most of them are already going to know what seller financing is. So for us, it's more so just like a conversation of saying, hey, let's do a seller carry. And they're like, okay. I see seller finance where they're completely ignorant to it, maybe in single family a little bit more, not so much in multi. Mason, would you agree or anything to add to that?
I would just add, there are a couple approaches that you can take if you do need to educate them. One, have a really good broker or wholesaler on your team. Really good brokers that know, that are worth their salt and know what they're doing, will educate the seller for you and in fact help them understand that, typically speaking, unless the seller is looking to place all of the money that they're receiving for you from you from this property into a completely different asset, which sometimes happens, but unless that's the case, typically speaking, sellers can make more money. Exactly. Typically speaking, sellers can make more money on seller finance, and a good broker knows that and will explain that for you to them. If you don't have a good broker and that's not the way that you can approach that particular seller, ask the broker to go directly to the seller and just have a very frank conversation with the seller. Hop on a phone call with the seller, explain what you're trying to do. Ask the seller what their needs are, what it is that they're trying to do. Let's say, for example, they just want out of a property because they're kind of done. They have some maybe $20,000 in medical expenses that they need to do. Let me give you an example on our motel. Our motel, the guys just, the family could not manage the motel at all anymore. They just did not have the physical capacity to do so. So we went to them and said, look, we want to seller finance this. What do you need? They said, we want to move back to the country that we're from. And we need to be able to afford some of the medical expenses for the husband. We said, great. How much is it going to cost for you to get back to your country and to pay off the medical expenses? $20,000. Great. We will pay you $20,000 down payment up front. How much do you need monthly in order to survive? $1,000 a month. Great. We'll pay you $20,000 up front, $1,000 a month moving forward for this long. 3 years on this amount of money. The purchase price was $130,000. For this long, we'll pay you the lump sum at the end of the 3 years. That way, your monthly expenses are taken care of. We just paid off your flight back to your country, moving back, and all of your medical expenses, and everybody's happy. But you have to get on the call with that seller in order to understand who they are and what they need. And then you can explain how it is that you, as the buyer, can serve them and add value to them through seller finance. Hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that was that. Dude, you're getting wonderful at this. Let's continue to two more questions, and then we'll continue through Dashima.
Yeah, actually, I had a few, but I'll try to make it quickly.
Oh no, you got it.
Okay, you mentioned using social media and keeping track. I was going to ask you, how do you use social media? And also, I have trouble in general keeping track of things because that also sometimes seems like work. How do you keep track of things and make yourself successful?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's kind of a loaded question too. So for social media, there are two things that I do on social media. First, I use it for tracking. Okay. So when you do, you can use social media to your advantage with tracking. If you're already going to be posting, just post the stuff that you're doing and use that for tracking, right? If you're shoot a quick one day, I can, you know, if I know that week, for example, I submitted 10 LOIs or something. On Friday, I'll be like, yo, look what I just did. I submitted 10 LOIs this week. Done. There's your tracking, because you can look back and say, oh, okay, I submitted 10 LOIs this week, 10 LOIs that week, 10 LOIs that week. And you just count them up really, really easily. Okay. So you can use social media for that tracking purpose. But then the other reason that I use social media is actually for finding deals. I basically just joined, I'm probably part of like 100+ real estate groups right now. And I literally just stalk those groups for deal finding like there's no tomorrow. I find the people that are posting about deals. I find the wholesalers, the brokers, the sellers that are directly posting on these in these groups, and I reach out to them directly and I just say, "Hey, saw that you posted about this deal." Whether it's in my buy box or not, doesn't matter. If it's not in my buy box, I just say, "Hey, I saw that you posted about the single family home. Was just curious, do you have any commercial multifamily in your pipeline? If you do, would love to see if we can work together on something." If it was something that you like, "Hey, saw that you posted about this. Would love to get more information on this. And maybe we can continue to do deals down the road together as well."
Yeah, that's helpful. What about the other things that you've tracked? Like, how are you doing it? Is it an Excel spreadsheet? Like, how do you...
Just an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, and Shima, you'll have all of that also in the Action Academy, like the onboarding. You just haven't gotten to that point yet. You'll have like the goal tracker. Yeah, and it will have you like break down your goal, and then it'll break down three priorities and then five strategies. And then you'll have like a little tick box where you can check off each one of them. But yeah, you become addicted to it when you realize that it... Like if any of you guys are feeling anxious, it's literally, I'm telling you, the cure to your anxiety with all real estate investing is just numbers. Mm-hmm. It's just numbers. Mason, can you give like a ballpark? How many deals did you have to underwrite to get a decent level of confidence in underwriting?
To get a decent level of confidence, probably about 100. And then I needed about triple that in order to feel really confident.
Fair. Okay. And then we'll do Dylan, and then we'll go into capital raising and then close out.
Hey guys. So quick question here. So I'm fairly familiar with underwriting deals, multifamily, can do pretty well, probably done 100+. Looking at commercial stuff, a lot of commercial stuff where I'm looking at is just expensive. Rates are expensive. You get the idea. You mentioned half and half seller, half bank finance. Does that eliminate, or does that bring down your, so banks, obviously a lot of commercial lenders want 60 to 70% loan to value, which means 30, 40% down. Yep. If you say, "Hey, I only need a loan on half the property," does that essentially, obviously the bank's not going to do no money down. How does that work?
Do they still want the 30, 40? That's a great question. So you really need to understand, do you have a good relationship with any lenders?
Nothing real strong yet.
Okay. So then my suggestion to you would be to like hop on the phone with some really good lenders. And I would actually look at like hyper local banks around wherever it is that you're trying to buy. Create relationships with these guys. Cause what you can do and what we do is we go on, I basically go to this guy, have a really good relationship with one guy. And I just say, "Look, I need, this is the total purchase price. I need about 50% LTV. You can be in first position. I need the seller to carry 40% of the remainder," right? So banks bring in 50, sellers carry in 40, and I'm going to be bringing 10. Are you cool with that? Any hoops that we can jump through? What are your requirements? Blah, blah, blah. And he just lays out, "Okay, if we're going to do that, seller's going to be in second position. We're going to be in first. We're going to need you to make sure that you're doing X and Y and Z. You're going to need to provide me proof that, you know, they did their due diligence or that they've signed this specific contract," and blah, blah, blah. But as long as you have that relationship with whatever lender that you're working with, they will help you understand what requirements you need to meet in order to have the seller carry that second loan. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And that, I think it makes a lot of sense of, you know, a lot of these, you find $1 million deal and they're like in normal bank or commercial lending's like, "Oh, we want $350,000 down." And you're like, "Yeah, 7.5%. And I'm going to make $64 a month."
Yeah. Not gonna happen.
On these old low market rents, you know, it's a joke. Yeah. I can never sleep and keep underwriting. So that's super helpful. It makes a lot of sense.
And part of that as well is a really good strategy, at least something that I choose to do, is because of how the market is currently going with debt. Debt's expensive right now and it kills a lot of deals. And so what you can do is when you're approaching these sellers, that's why I submit three different options in my LOIs, because I can say, "Look what I can do with debt right now." If they're asking for $1 million, with debt, if I'm going to a bank, I can only get you $700,000. Granted, that $700,000 is upfront, sure, but I can only get you $700,000. If you're willing to seller carry, and if you're willing to, I don't know, do X terms, I can get you $950,000. I can get you almost exactly what you want. And if you're seller carrying, you have interest on this over the next 5 years, you're making more than your $1 million at a 950 purchase price with me than you would have been if I just gave you $700,000 with the bank. And so that, if you get good terms and you convince these guys to go to seller finance, it helps you long-term A, cash flow, and B, make sure that the seller's happy and you're getting the deal done in the way that works for you. And if you're bringing on any investors, it also helps them. I hope that helps.
Yeah, I tried to do something like that recently and the guy was all like, oh, I don't know about all that, basically. So I was like, okay, well, thank you.
Yeah. No, yeah. Just keep pushing. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, right, right.
So,
yep.
Yeah. So let's do the capital raise really quickly and then we'll close out, Mason. I want to we'll keep this one tied at 60. Cool. So for the capital raise, total capital raise, $474,000. Total personal capital invested, $120 because he paid for his own LLC. And then 23 capital partner relationships built, not all invested, but most asked that I bring deals to them in the future. Walk us through, how did you approach capital partners when it was specifically in the context of raising for this? And then how do you keep them updated and nurtured for the future?
Yep. So essentially, as you're going through and you're creating these relationships, it's what we started up with from the get-go, right? So I said at the beginning, you want to be creating as many relationships as you possibly can. 2 to 3 people a day was what I chose to do. When you're meeting that amount of people and you're creating that many relationships, chances are you're going to come across someone that's got 100K they got to throw at something. As you're getting to know these people, write down, keep a little list of whoever it is that you've met. If they have some capital, you know that they're trying to place, write it down. Keep up with them. Keep letting them know, hey, I'm doing this. Hey, I saw this deal. Hey, I'm working on this. Let them know that you're doing stuff. Post on social media and make sure that they're following you or that you're following them so that they can see that you're doing stuff. And that is the social media especially is a good way to keep that relationship up because they constantly see that you're doing stuff. And so you are constantly in the back of their head because if they're scrolling, chances are they're going to see you pop up on their feed, especially if you're posting every single day. Once you have a deal not under contract, once you have a deal that you've submitted an LOI on and it's been accepted, you can shoot a quick text or email feeler out to them and just say, hey, just so you know, I got this deal. Curious, are you still looking to place 100K? They say yes. Great. Let them know. Awesome. Let me get this deal under contract. I'll get you the numbers over and let's see if we can make something work. But you can also let them know if there's a chance it might not. So no worries at all. If they come back and they say no, and they say, you know, I don't have any money, say, totally cool. Let me know when you do. And let's see if we can do a deal together later on. But you just constantly keep up with them and let them know that you're doing stuff. So that way you keep top of mind.
Yeah, that's huge. Oh my gosh. And for me, what we also do, it's actually kind of funny because for like social media, like I just post about even what I'm thinking about in the future. So for instance, I'm posting a lot about boutique hotels right now. And I just have done that over the last couple of days. Now, granted, I've built an audience now, but it's hilarious that like I sold all my real estate. So it's like, I don't even have any real estate right now. I'm going to buy some here in the future. But it's just like, I don't even have any. And now everyone's coming to me. And I had freaking like 40 DMs of people saying that they want to invest in boutique hotels with me. I'm like, all right, well, I guess we're investing in boutique hotels. So it works at each level. And I used to do that too. Like, I would just be like, hey, this is what I'm looking into. Like, so you can just post about like what you're doing. Remember, you don't have to say, hey, I've got hundreds of units. Look at me. It's like, hey, like I'm in the process right now of buying like 60 units. Like, this is super fun. Here's all the parts associated with it. So in closing, let's break down the ownership percentages and how you broke these down.
Yes. So these ones, as of right now, all of these estimated numbers here. So you see, this is between two deals, year one. I'm actually, now that we're in March, I'm actually making a lot more than this right now. But we tried to be as conservative as we possibly could up front, in order to make sure that we were making enough money on our end, yes, as the asset managers, but also we were making our capital partners enough money so that they were incentivized to bring as much money to our deals as possible and that we were going to be making the money, right? And so when we were looking at this, I basically broke down, okay, for this 12 unit, I'm not bringing, so the 12 unit and the 24 unit, remember, were the first two deals I ever did. And I mean, I was still brand new to doing all this, right? And so I was okay taking a much smaller cut up front, sure, than I am now, for example, on this 26 unit, right? Like I'm taking a larger cut on this 26 unit because I know what I'm doing now. But at first, I didn't take a very large cut. So I own 12% of anything and everything that is that this property does for me. Okay, cash flow from laundry and other sources of income to rent to anything else that comes in. We also have money sitting in a money market account that makes interest. We also get a portion, 12% of that type deal. That is that 12%, and this 33% is literally everything that all the money that the property makes and brings in. I get 12% and I get 33% of that. I was as conservative as I could be with these first numbers. We have since broke these numbers. I am actually bringing in this month, I'm bringing in just shy of $2,000 this month, just on these two deals where I underwrote. So I'm almost making double what I originally underwrote. And the goal here is for after 4 years, both properties combined, is for this to be almost double as well. But again, these are what the minimum of what I would be bringing in between the first year and then the final 4 years.
Yeah, that doesn't even take into account like the debt snowball, like the debt pay down, equity roll ups, and all that different stuff.
Taxes, yep, all of that.
Yeah. So then somebody asked for this next deal, the 26th unit, how are you splitting that? And are you putting any money down for that?
Nope, no money. And splitting it. So how we're doing it is we are raising about just shy of 1.2 mil for it. Okay. We raised the full amount, including for like EMD and for, you know, inspections and all of that stuff. I upfront to start, we're actually splitting it 85-15. So 85 to the investors, 15 for us. And that is because we're purchasing full cash. Okay. So we're not going to debt and we don't have seller finance. It was a unique deal. So we had to raise the full 1.2 in order to buy this property. And then when we refinance, which will refinance, really, it's just bringing debt to this, within the first 3 months, we're then doing an equity flop of 70-30. On this one, the equity split total on it was a 24-76 split. Okay. And so now we're at a 70-30 split for the first 2 to 3 years. And then the goal is to refinance one more time in order to turn it into a 50-50 split between all the investors and us. And so this particular deal is a little bit more unique and a little bit more in depth than what we did here. This 12% is for 4 years of ownership. Once we hit the 4 years of ownership, we're going to decide whether we sell or refinance. If we refinance, maybe we'll reach out about different equity flops, et cetera, et cetera. But this is just straight 12%. This is straight 33% until we sell or refinance. The one that we're currently working on, we worked in different equity changes over the course of ownership as we add value to the property and return investor money over the course of the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years. Hope that answered your question.
Heck yeah, man. This has been freaking awesome, dude. You are absolutely wonderful at this. I don't know where all this came from, but we need to get you on some podcasts, man. This has been wonderful.
Awesome.
Dude, I'll send a couple emails after this and I'll get you probably in front of about 1 million people. So I think yes. I'm about seven emails will get you there. They'll take my emails now. Dude, awesome. Let's share before I promote anything about me, dude. You're the star of the show. Like this, you freaking crush this. Where can people find you? And then how can we all add value to you?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So, I mean, I'm on Instagram, The Real Man Miranda, or on Facebook, Just Mason Miranda. You can find me. I'm usually the one that has pictures of his family with his kid. Now, that's me. I also posted just a crap ton about real estate. And then just adding value. Honest to goodness, we're really just looking to grow our network. So if you have deals, would love to see them. Love to partner with you, see how we can work out. If you have money or if you know people that have money, would love to meet those people or to meet you as well, because we'd love your money. We'd love to make you a shit ton of money and do the same. So,
dude, let's rock and roll. And then I'll do a little plug. We got the book, From Passive to Passionate, How to Quit Your Job, Grow Your Wealth, Turn Your Passions into Profits. A lot of the stuff he just talked about is within our book. You guys should buy it. You don't need an online course. This is freaking like $14. So you can get that. You can follow Mason for free. He will gladly respond to your DMs. He doesn't have $100,000 a year executive assistant yet, but you know, maybe in a couple of years he will. But guys, thank you so much for coming on. Mason, thank you for coming on. And as always, guys, if you are interested in this, you have a couple of properties, I would go check out the Action Academy community. That is where me and Mason met. This is where everything was incubated. And that's where, like, what caused us to be where it is today. Stephanie, if you could post my personal Calendly link in the chat really quickly for them to book a call. I believe she did. Yep. So there's all the links that have the podcast, that have Mason's episode, that has Mason's Instagram. And then also, if you click the link at the very bottom, that's to book a personal call with us and our team to apply for Action Academy Community. I will tell you how much it is. It is $7,000 a year because I don't really have anything to sell you. So we'll pause there, guys. Thank you so, so much for coming on. This has been absolutely wonderful. And we will be doing a lot more of these. Mason, thank you for being you. Guys, thanks for coming on. Enjoy the rest of your evenings. Bye-bye.
Thanks, y'all.